what are we doing when the entire byword of the Christian is not choosing, but being chosen to love? And now we are being told, both through abortion and euthanasia, that you can only kill your family. You can't kill a stranger. You can totally kill your family, and you can only kill them when they're at their weakest. What if that were the conversation? That's what the bishops brought. That's what the Catholic Church brings. That was the human rights standard to which John Paul II lifted our eyes, and the Church has held in that, in those terms since that time.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds, seeking the moral high ground for 20 years. Pro-life, pro-family, and Catholic values have guided us to the top.
The Catholic Church sees something very special in motherhood, and the ministry Mighty Is Her Call is helping countless moms understand why it is a sacred vocation. Subscribe to their blog and podcast. Invite Mighty Is Her Call to offer a one-day retreat in your parish or diocese. You could even download an audio retreat so that you can enjoy mother's retreats in the privacy of your own home or small group. Click on the link above or below in the description and let Mighty Is Her Call share with you how the vocation of motherhood is a sacred and worthy life calling that is united to Christ's total gift of self. So, Helen, how are you? So great to have you with us here on A Reason for Hope. Thank you for joining us.
I'm okay. Thank you. And how are you?
I'm awesome. So great that we finally connected. It's wonderful to speak with you and share this time with you. And I have so many questions for you. You've had an amazing career. You've been involved. You're a teacher. You're an attorney. You're an author. I guess the million-dollar question is, what got you interested in law, you know, and what was the impetus to draw you towards studying law and becoming a lawyer?
Two things. I guess I always wanted to be an effective advocate. I grew up with a sister with disabilities, participated in some disabilities rights groups, spent a summer at a mission run by a Catholic order of priests, the Passionists, who were like in the Northeast U.S., working in prisons and with the children of prisoners and in nursing homes and with the people in the mountains who needed some housing. And I always wanted to be one of the sort of pushy or effective people in American society. And that very much in the U.S. includes lawyers.
That's good. And share a little bit about just your schooling. Was it easy for you? What law school did you go to?
Well, I went to Cornell,
right.
I always tell students who are struggling in the first semester, which is many, or if they're not really struggling, they think they are, you know, that I had a super rough beginning. I was so certain that I was meant to be a lawyer, and I go to Cornell. I come from a town outside of Philly, went to a Catholic college, Villanova, had a easy romp through there, graduated in 3 years at the top of my class. I get to Cornell, I'm just 20, and I was surrounded by people with, the average age was 26, so the average age was 6 years my senior, and they had had some pretty magnificent and even international backgrounds, and I just tanked that first semester. And I did pray hard, and I said to my father, and I said in prayer, listen, if the second semester doesn't pick up, I'll give it all I have. Then this isn't for me. And I worked unbelievably hard and ended up doing very well. And I was like, okay, God, I'm going to take that as a signal to go forward. But it's not easy for anyone. I mean, there are some just natural natural legal minds. I've seen students who are just built for this, but I had to work for it.
You're a religious person. I know that you study theology. Did you get your master's in theology?
Yeah, I did. I started to have a it wasn't even a midlife crisis. I was like 25. And midlife crisis for the Middle Ages, maybe. But I had a midlife crisis at my law firm, a big corporate litigation firm in Philly, when I realized that, you know, I wanted to do something always for God as well as, you know, something accomplished. And corporate litigation didn't seem to be enough for that. So I went back to night school to study theology while I was practicing as a corporate lawyer. I was married, but my husband was living in a separate city. And so I had my nights free. And this convinced me to pursue it full time. So he and I eventually moved back to DC. I got my master's and I went 2.5 more years in the doctoral program in systematic theology. When the US bishops for whom I was working part-time asked me to come full-time into the bishops' conference.
Is that how your pro-life work started?
Yeah. Although when I started with them, yeah, I was a regular litigator. So now my client was the bishop. So we did amicus briefs in the Supreme Court on all the really controversial stuff, abortion, capital punishment, euthanasia, free exercise of religion. And the way it happened was very God's hand, super, super heavy, heaviest hand I've ever seen from God in my life. Where I was asked to rush to go on a TV program because it had become public. The U.S. bishops were going to launch this massive PR campaign on pro-life. And they said, Helen, we don't have anyone else to defend us. We're getting killed in the press. You're a lawyer. You've written our briefs in the Supreme Court. Would you just drop everything and go to New York and do the Today Show and Good Morning America and Charlie Rose? And like they literally sent me like a hair and makeup guy from a PR firm. And I ran to a store and bought a suit that would look good on TV. And they trained me on the train on the way up to New York to how to do TV. And I'm the opening act on the morning shows. And it went great. And this little clamor began to happen internally. Well, why doesn't she lead our pro-life campaign? It was, you know, I guess, and again, my background, I had been training in voice and I had been a singer and a, you know, actor in high school and college. And it was like God brought it all together, law, religion, performance. It was very weird how he did it. And so I resisted the call to go into the pro-life office because I wanted to be a PhD theologian until in my only smells and bells experience of my life, really. I mean, other than marrying my husband, that was clear. I just was at Mass and it became understood in my head that I would accept full time in pro-life with the bishops against my will.
What is your feeling today? I mean, there's a misconception that while the Catholic Church is certainly very pro-life, it doesn't seem tangibly that it depicts that or the voicing of the church isn't bold enough. What are your thoughts of what's going on with the church today?
Oh, good question. And I don't like you for it because
I'm sorry.
I have to be a little critical. I don't mean that personally. I mean that professionally. I will start with the context, which is there's a lot of wonderful pro-life groups out there. You know, some of my favorite have always been like Feminists for Life and recently Rehumanize and, you know, Americans United for Life does marvelous legal work and Lila Rose does unbelievable, you know, uncovering of things. When the bishops and the dioceses spoke more in the public square, they bring a gravitas, a dignity, and a marriage of faith and reason. You know, there's a reason why me, sort of a, you know, an academic, was willing to do that for them for 10 years because I was so attracted to the combination of intelligence and faith. And I had noticed anecdotally when I was doing it that in states or regions where the bishops were very active, the debate had a higher level. And it was less soundbitey. It had a depth to it. And when I was out, I was on the road for the bishops 100 days a year before I had kids. And I was doing universities and state legislators and newspaper editorial boards. I don't see the same presence today. And my heart aches a bit for that, because I think therefore the debate lacks some of the lifting our eyes up to what ought to be spoken about more. I don't see it at the national level. In some dioceses, I mean, it's very variable through dioceses. Some dioceses are still terrific. But, you know, we should be addressing this as this human rights cause, equality regarding the vulnerable. We should be saying, you know, John Paul II, your patron, wrote the most brilliant summary of the difficulty here. He said in Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life encyclical in 1995, he said, think about this in a human rights manner, which is how he always approached it. You are taking a human being, nobody disputes this, at the most vulnerable time of their lives. You are asking the person most capable, therefore most charged to protect the child, to be the one who destroys, and you're calling it a human right. What's wrong with this picture? And the U.S. bishops then, in a document that is my favorite, and they issued the very next year, Faithful for Life, said, what are we doing when the entire byword of the Christian is not choosing, but being chosen to love? And now we are being told, both through abortion and euthanasia, that you can only kill your family. You can't kill a stranger. You can totally kill your family, and you can only kill them when they're at their weakest. What if that were the conversation? That's what the bishops brought. That's what the Catholic Church brings. That was the human rights standard to which John Paul II lifted our eyes, and the Church has held in that, in those terms since that time. And I'm not seeing it out there.
Yeah, you made some really interesting comments. It just affirms that you mentioned organizations. The laity is very engaged these days, more so than I see the church. And I see some sadness there as well, the boldness that we really need. We need the leaders to speak out. But maybe you could share in your experience and maybe what's going on. Are there any resources that the church is offering for women that need help or choosing life? What is the church doing in that regard? Do you know of anything?
So there's several things. First, of course, in every diocese, there is a Catholic Charities, and they are deeply committed to women in need. The crisis pregnancy centers, of which I always hear is about 3,000 in the U.S.
The latest number is 2,000.
It's 2,000.
2,000, yeah, because I'll explain, but we're in the process of producing a film called Choice, and there's just about 2,000 pregnancy crisis centers. And interesting enough, there is a little over 900 abortion clinics, which is interesting. It's a fact.
2 to 1.
Yeah, that people, you would think the opposite, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. Well, in those crisis pregnancy services, you know, Catholics have often taken the lead. Dioceses cooperate, churches cooperate, Catholic schools cooperate. I remember my daughter's Catholic high school cooperating very closely with one particular clinic. She was in D.C., they were here in Maryland, collecting money, running events, collecting diapers. And there's also at the national level, the pro-life office at the Bishops' Conference organized helped local dioceses and parishes organize an effort called Walking with Women in Need, which basically tells them how. So that it's actually done by the locals, but the national office helped them sort of organize it, which is a good function for a national office, you know, to not have the local parishes and dioceses have to reinvent the wheel. And it was how to mobilize local resources in order to provide help to women who come. A lot of parishes are also something called Gabriel parishes, where they have people in the parish organized to help particular women. I'll tell you a quick story about that. I met three women in Texas, and one of them had dreamed up the idea. Angel Gabriel. And when I was out and about 100 days a year, I totally learned how bottom-up the pro-life movement is. I fell in love with those people. I still love them. And they invented Project Gabriel. I dragged that woman to a national meeting. She told every diocese about it, and then boom, it hit every diocese in the country. But it came from one group of women in one little place in Texas.
That's awesome. So a significant number of Americans remain uninformed about the nuances of Roe v. Wade and the 2022 Dobbs ruling. Could you please explain some of the common misconceptions perpetuated by mainstream media regarding these landmark decisions for our listeners and our viewers? As an attorney,
yeah,
I'm sure you could do that very clearly.
I'll do it quick. So the main one with Roe and the main one with Dobbs. The main one with Roe was the idea that somehow it had any limits to abortion. It did not. It said that there was a constitutional right, that it was a fundamental right. And fundamental rights in the Constitution are those that mandate the strongest protection. And people believe that Roe cut it off at a particular time or for particular reasons. Oh, rape, incest only after 3 months, only after 6 months. But in fact, what it said is, even in the last trimester, states must allow abortion for a woman's life or health, and then went on to define health in its companion case, which was called Doe v. Bolton, but it had the same holdings applied to both, as, and I am quoting, all factors, physical, psychological, emotional, familial, or the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient, unquote. No state was permitted to limit abortion for any reason. And that is such a misunderstanding about Roe. With regard to Dobbs, people think two things. One, that Dobbs banned abortion. When in fact, what it simply did was say Roe was wrong. There's no constitutional right in the federal constitution. To the extent states want to regulate it, they have to do it under state law. Second, there's a sort of feminist misconception about Dobbs, that the court consulted law back in 1858 when the constitutional provision that Roe put abortion in was drafted, the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, and that they went back to a time when women couldn't vote and said, hey, we like the history and tradition of this period in the U.S. when women had no say. And you know what? Abortion was illegal. Go. Abortion is not in the Constitution. What the Supreme Court actually did was go back to like the Magna Carta, okay? And wow, all the way forward through the Constitution, through the 14th Amendment, and right up till the night before Roe versus Wade. And they said at all times in the United States, abortion was either completely or mostly banned. That is not a recipe for a constitutional right founded on the idea that people's understanding of liberty requires a constitutional right of abortion. This country was against abortion before, during, and after these constitutional amendments were passed. So the idea that it was a strike against the feminists or against women is complete and utter nonsense.
Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed with contrarian thinking. Their independent research and analysis provide a deep understanding of our investments with the intent to avoid or minimize unpleasant surprises. This helps to ensure that their funds' investments match your moral beliefs. The advisor invests in securities only if they meet the fund's investment and religious requirements, and as such, the return may be lower or higher than if the advisor made decisions solely based on investment considerations. The fund's method of security selection may or may not be successful, and the fund may underperform or outperform the stock market as a whole. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. For a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, charges, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, call 1-866-AVE-MARIA. That's 1-866-283-6274. Or visit the link above or below in the description. Are you or someone close to you a Catholic mother? Are you giving all you've got to raise a holy, happy family? Mighty Is Your Call is a ministry that encourages Catholic mothers by proclaiming the radically Christ-like nature of motherhood. They offer retreats for moms throughout the nation. downloadable audio retreats so that you can enjoy mother's retreats in the privacy of your own home or in a small group, a blog featuring the writing of many open-to-life Catholic mothers, and a podcast accompanying mothers in their day-to-day experiences of motherhood. They aim to be a favorite resource for moms who are living out the Catholic calling of motherhood. Visit the link above or below in the description to inquire about hosting a retreat in your parish or diocese, access their online materials, and also subscribe to their blog. In preparing for this interview, I came across one of your books, Religious Freedom After the Sexual Revolution. You wrote that not too long ago, right?
Correct. I published it less than 2 years ago.
So you shared that the church wins most of our religious legal battles, such as under the First Amendment or the religious freedom restoration laws. However, and this is really cool, that we're losing the war. Maybe you could share a little bit about what you mean by that.
I wrote that book because even at a time when we're winning cases at the Supreme Court and in many lower courts on religious freedom, we're being most challenged by the sexual expression issues. Cohabitation, contraception, abortion, same-sex marriage, transgender issues. And when we enter the fray, we say things like, hey, we have a right not to cooperate with this because, well, we got a rule. Or I'm a Catholic high school and, you know, I really can't have the same-sex married teacher here. Well, because we have a rule. And what do we get? We get complete backlash. You people are hypocrites, you're sex abusers anyway, you hate women, you hate gay people. And I proposed in this book that we have to do a whole lot better and say, not only do we have, you know, a historic and gorgeous right to religious freedom, you know, that a lot of countries don't have, but in addition, these so-called rules are actually gifts of love that we bring not only to Catholics, but to the whole community. And that in the course of achieving religious freedom in these cases, we have to say, by the way, what we want religious freedom for is to witness to the beauty of Christian love and frankly, human love that applies to all people in these arenas. And here's our gift to you. So no to defensiveness. Yes to using these cases to explain our beautiful teachings.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, you know, the perception is that we're discriminating, right? Or we're being really rigid and unmoving in our position. And what we're failing, even in all aspects, I believe, in our faith, is that we're not telling our story, the beauty of who we are as Catholics.
That would be you. That would be your mission.
That's exactly what Array of Hope does. I mean, we're trying to share the why, you know, why we do things as Catholics, what our teachings are rooted in. So, and I hate to continually, you know, look upon the church, but I think it's the laity. Maybe you could share what your thoughts are. I mean, I think that's the future of the church. I mean, often, you know, you mentioned some of those, you know, the hot buttons, contraception, abortion, same-sex attraction, same-sex relations, you know, transgenderism, you know, cohabitation. These are all things that people just don't understand why we have these positions in our church teaching. Maybe your thoughts and comments?
So the hardest thing I did in that book, Religious Freedom After the Sexual Revolution, was to explain the why of our positions. Then I mapped it onto the legal framework. Then I said, here's how you would explain it. Here's how you would do it to a court of law. Here's how you would do it to a court of public opinion. So I did long explanations and then I you know, made them shorter and gave a couple paragraphs for people to use. So just for an example, one of my very, very favorites in talking about the radicality of Christian love and the sacredness of the body, that people love radical love. The Me Too movement, you know, wakes us up again to the sacredness of the body. And I go back and I show that from the beginnings of Christianity to the present, Christians, what a wonderful historian Kyle Harper calls conspicuous chastity, you know, something they were very famous for in the early part of the church and still, was born of this understanding of Christian love as radical. I show, for instance, that the very same people who were the strongest about our commitment to the bodies of the poor and the diseased and the disabled and the immigrant where the same early preachers committed to our positions on the body sexually. I show that women were ecstatic about our conspicuous chastity. No longer could the husband write home, which we have evidence of old letters in the Roman tradition, and say, hey, if the baby's sick, leave it on a hill to die. If the baby's a girl, leave it on the hill to die. If I need to bring another wife home, I'll let you know. If I want to divorce you, I'll say I divorced thee three times. That all of these were such good news for women who became some of the strongest followers, right? The widows did not feel obliged to remarry anymore, right? Their identity was child of God, sister of Christ. It was no longer, I am this man's wife, I am this man's mother, I am this man's daughter. Christianity was so freeing. There's this gorgeous quotation from this book by a Yale classics scholar, Sarah Rudin, where she says, imagine how beautiful this was, this good news. It meant you were no longer subject to exploitation and no longer able to be treated like a thing. I mean, think about that. Isn't that still good news, especially to women today? So I try and go back, you know, ressourcement, Christianity, going back to the old stuff and bringing it forward and saying, you know how it was beautiful and it exploded on the world as good news? It's still good news. But we have to learn how to communicate it. You can't just know this stuff. You have to practice how to say it.
And the thing, part of the problem is that it's been there since day one. It's been the fabric of our teachings from the very beginning. But it is impacting really the young today, young adults in particular. I mean, the decline in marriages, decline in baptisms. It's scary and astounding. What your thoughts?
Yeah. there is a book by University of Texas sociologist. I think he's a convert to Catholicism and the most brilliant sociologist, you know, he's at a top university on the subject of sex, marriage, and dating. And it's called Cheap Sex. His name is Mark Regnerus. I pretty much didn't let my daughter read it because I didn't want her to be in despair. You know, she is happily married to a beautiful man just recently, but the world, the setup for our children and grandchildren in a world where sex, marriage, and parenting have been split, in a world where we don't demand radical love, in a world where the body isn't sacred, in a world where our teachings about sex are understood to be not only hateful, they call us unchristian, which is very, very devastating, but amusing at the same time. And they often learn the hard way, but I do believe it is imperative if we are really charitable as church to put an awful lot of effort into this. This is not something to the side. You know, God tells us that his model for understanding his identity and Christian love is the bride, bridegroom, and the parent child. How will they understand even the basics, the architecture of Christianity, if they don't understand marriage and children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it is rooted just to, you know, getting our church to have an encounter with Christ. I think we're so focused on, not that this is bad, you know, early on going through CCD programs and the catechesis, getting the kids all to get their sacraments and boom, and they're gone. And we forget that we should really be focusing on getting them to know who Christ is, the encounter. And I think the ramifications, over the years are being compounded. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the Pew Research survey that indicated 7 out of 10 Catholics do not believe, you know, in the true presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. They think it's a symbol. And I think that's just a compounding of the reality of what's happening within the church, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make this interview negative. I'm trying to point out the areas of where hope resides, right?
Yes.
You know, where we can make things better, especially with what the bishops are doing today with the Eucharistic revival, which Array of Hope is involved in. I think that's really impacted a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with you. And there, you know, again, there are beautiful efforts. I'm in touch with things that the California bishops are launching and emphasizing, with things that the Diocese of Arlington is doing nearby. I work with a group called Communio, which you may have heard of.
J.P. DeGrant's.
They are just doing tremendous work in dioceses and parishes, not only regarding marriage, but regarding dating and having frank conversations and, you know, helping people to have fun and to take joy in the church's teaching. It's hard, hard work. It's expensive to get it off the ground. But I think this family issue is quite central. I always say it's not like a sign hanging off the edge of the building saying, hey, this is moralism and everything else we do is nice to people. No, this is core. This is core stuff.
Yeah. And I agree with that. I mean, as a church, which is good, we spend millions of dollars on young people, and they have all these programs in these parishes, but where you go to a parish and where's there a program on strengthening the marriage or, informing how to keep our families Catholic, right?
Yeah.
There's no money spent there. And as you mentioned, these are...
Now, the Communio has documented that.
Right on.
The figures are pretty shocking.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I wanted to share, given your pro-life background, I think when we first started talking about a year or two ago, I shared with you the film that A Ray of Hope is involved in called Choice. And essentially, we profiled over a dozen women that were confronted with a pregnancy crisis situation, an unplanned pregnancy. And the film is called Choice specifically because what are the choices that women have around the country based on their economic background, their family upbringing? And it varies drastically, you know? And what are the choices that are truly available? You terminate the child, and what do those ramifications look like? You keep the child, seek pregnancy crisis centers or maternity centers for help, or you offer the child up for adoption. And we investigate and really go deep into those areas. And part of our approach and technique or desire is to bring in both sides of the debate in to view this film. Mm. With the idea that we've discovered that there is empathy, both are in agreement that they have empathy toward the woman. So that's the common ground.
Yes. So, that is, you just described it. That's the common ground. Yes, that's perfect.
And our hope is that... I don't want to be trite, but the hope is to have some form of a discussion where we're sharing ideas and hopefully being able to influence them, as you stated, through love, through empathy, through the rationale of reason, right? To convey and make them understand what's at stake. So this film is going to be released, God willing, next year. We've been working on it for 8 years. We're very, very excited about it. Just want to know your thoughts on that philosophy and what you think about that approach.
Couple things. First, I hope and I have a feeling that you've already thought of this, that you're going to program the reception of this so that colleges have discussions, high schools have discussions. I think that would be terrific. You could even have, maybe there could be a television event where people have that discussion after seeing it. A second thing, I don't know whether it's my age or the amount of experience I have in this area. I am skeptical, even if the common ground is the woman, that the majority of the answer lies in providing services to the woman in a crisis. There's a massive context behind that, which is her upbringing, her understanding of the relationship with the father, her understanding of her own capabilities and opportunities, her thinking about what's in the womb, her thinking about being a mother. To me, I think this kind of remote preparation has to start when they're a kid, and to have conversations about things that will lead a person ultimately to be able to accept a child not on their timetable. So, I wrote an earlier book, it's a small book with Cambridge University Press in England called Putting Children's Interests First in U.S. Family Law and Policy, where I recommended that if the law was going to get a piece of this, aside from the church, just the secular law, it basically needed to alert people when it's going to go on and educate them on contraception. Listen, you know, we actually have more unplanned pregnancies, not less, since the government started distributing this. We have more abortion, not less. Mm-hmm. And you need to think about the well-being of children and all this. You're going to create a child in a situation that's, you know, largely, usually outside of marriage, where you're going to be faced with a terrible dilemma. And you ought to be thinking about this earlier. So for us in the religious sphere, and even in the secular sphere, to educate women and men way earlier about the child's coming first, about the vulnerability of children, our responsibility to them, about not having sex in circumstances where you cannot welcome that child. Because you know what? None of those choices is easy. Not rearing, not adoption, not abortion. Yeah. And you are going to put yourself in a terrible situation if you are having a sexual relationship without the slightest concern for that child. You know, yeah. Frankly, you're also going to have a less than wonderful sexual and personal relationship if sex has come before commitment. That it turns out the church's whole, oh, you know, blah, blah, procreative, unitive, put it together. Everyone thinks this is ancient language. Turns out when you take the procreative, even the idea of it out of the unitive, you take away tomorrow. You take away the notion of kin, family, love goes out the window. It turns out God knew what he was doing when he put the idea that sex makes babies together with sex. It has a way of making a romantic couple think, what about tomorrow? Or is this just about today, about my body, about an instinct? I'm a fan of a way bigger, deeper conversation about women, feminism, marriage, men, sex, all of that, long before you get to how are we going to deal with the woman in a crisis. The latter is necessary. I don't think it's at all sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. The point of this film is I think that I think a lot of what you mentioned just doesn't exist in impoverished areas or women that are fractured homes. It's just, in my experience, we've interviewed over 250 women. It's just wow. It's not even a part of their mind the way they think.
Wow.
So the point of the film for us is that, and by the way, this is another personal statistic. Out of all the many, many women that I've interviewed, I feel that there's 30%, 15% of the culture is staunch, let's say pro-life, and you're not going to change their mind no matter what. 15% is staunch pro-choice. You're not going to change their mind no matter what. But there is 70% that at any given moment is malleable. Anything, I mean, even we're finding statistics that a large percentage of women that are having abortions are Catholics. So on any given moment, someone can make a choice that will last a lifetime at a moment. So the idea of what we're trying to do is that we're trying to invoke doubt into a person's mind, into their way of thinking or what they might have thought the truth to be. So if we instill doubt, then there's a possibility that they might change their perception and the idea. Because I agree with you, it has to start when you're young, but it's just not possible. In what I've experienced and going around the country and interviewing and being with some of these families, I mean, it's crazy. You know, it's really, you know, so anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. And, you know, it's our hope, and pray for us regarding that film.
Yes, I will.
In a prior interview, I heard you say, you quoted a passage that I absolutely love, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. It states, "But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you to give the reason for hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect." I mean, that's the name of our podcast, A Reason for Hope. So, what is your personal sense of hope? You know, where do you have hope? Do you remember saying that in an interview or you don't?
That's one of my favorite quotations as a sort of guide for my public talks at all.
I mean, we based our whole podcast on just that line. We love it, you know, but there is hope in the church. And sometimes we forget that, you know, the house rests in Christ and Christ wins in the end. Right. You know, so, share, what do you think?
Well, I'm on two tracks right now. And without getting teary on a podcast, my husband passed away two years ago.
I'm so sorry about
and
that.
And so that. It is difficult to hope in my own future. I pray, I trust, largely in darkness at the moment, that God has a vocation for me at this time in my life. So on a personal level, I feel just incapable of anything. As a Catholic, and for the church and for Christ in the world, my interaction with both has a lot of hope, because as a academic, I'm so blown away by the genius of the church. As a grown-up, a woman who teaches over 100 students a year, a woman who's raised children, I see such beauty in my students and in my children. And I have seen God reach them and reach other people I know in ways that I like out of left field doesn't even begin to describe how creative he is. So having seen lives unfold, having seen God reach people who anyone would have said were unreachable, having seen people become able to love in a Christ-like way when anyone would have said that was impossible for them, having met bishops and priests and lay people and sisters who are absolutely under the heading of God's gift to the world, I have hope. So I have concrete, trustworthy, empirically based, intellectually based hope in Christ and in the church, because I've seen the results. Struggling with whatever part I might have in that now, when sort of all the fun and all the color in life was taken with my husband.
Yeah. I want to, you know, I'm so sorry. When we were talking together, I don't know if you remember, we had lunch together about a year ago in California, and you were sharing a lot of this. And the thing that just comes to me right away is that God heals, and he don't give up. Always be faithful, and I know that you will be. Maybe it's another part of your life that you'll experience, and not to be less compassionate, but maybe there's another way that you can share what you've experienced to others and bring hope to them and how you're feeling this pain. And I'm sure I've never experienced a loss of my own spouse, but I know that it's unmanageable. I can't even imagine. I'm getting teary-eyed and emotional thinking about it right now. So I will pray for you, and I'll pray for your family. But I know God is in it. You know, it's part of our lives, and we have to pray that, you know, in one way or another, that you know, in eternity, in heaven, you know, we'll be meeting somehow. I don't know. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what it looks like doctrinally if we are able to meet and share with our spouses. But I know that there is opportunity to see loved ones in heaven. I've read that. And
thank you.
You know, you're an amazing example of the faith. You're an amazing example as an attorney. I want to wish you all the best moving forward. Professionally, are you still doing more of the speaking at colleges and universities? I think you're going to be speaking at Napa this year, right? Is that right?
No, I did not do that this year.
Was that last year? That was last year.
That was last year. I've done that in the past.
Right.
I do a lot. This summer, sort of the biggest thing I'm doing is with Archbishop Fisher of Sydney and other bishops in Australia. I am doing a 2-week religious freedom speaking tour of Australia.
Oh, wow.
They have a lot of controversies over there. You know, they're an English Commonwealth country. We have so much in common in the United States and there. I don't presume to come in and tell anyone what to do, but I can come in and talk about the Catholic Church's approach to this. They've got issues in Catholic schools and other Catholic institutions that are quite similar to us in the United States, except the government is even a bit less understanding of religious freedom there. So I'm going in and doing Canberra, Perth, Melbourne, Sydney for a bit and speaking on religious freedom in all of those places.
Yeah, I know that the church is suffering over there in a big way. Again, we talked about this. It's just we just have to share the beauty of the church and the reason and the logic. And yes, like you said, the genius.
Yes, the genius of it.
The genius
of it. I'm always impressed by that.
I mean, it's like unbelievable. You know, it's just how everything fits together like an absolutely perfect glove because it was divinely created, right? God put it all together.
And even the mysteries that we can't fully plumb, it's not that they're unreasonable. It's that we can't fully plumb them, and they are incredibly inspiring. And then from time to time, you get a glimpse of something about that mystery that you go, oh my gosh. You know, when it says, you know, he was last shall be first, and you're like, no, that works. Mm-hmm. It's a mystery, but it's true. I just saw it.
Yeah.
I try to keep that. I'm never bored working in the church. I say that all the time. It is infinitely interesting. And I can read all the time as I do and never get to the bottom of it, but in a good way.
Yeah. I will pray for you that you experience God's grace in a profound way to give you the source and energy to move forward. I know for me that every once in a while when I get low and I feel disconnected, I just pray for that and focus on that. And he comes through and gives me, yeah, I'm here. Here I am. All right. You're doing good. Keep going. You know, and that's all I need every once in a while. Or recall the moments, those experiences that you had, those profound experiences that connected you to the living God. And that is, you know, the assurance, right? We all go through our various levels of difficulty, and God is good.
Thank you.
All right, listen, it was so awesome to spend this time with you, Helen. I wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll get to meet and talk soon.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity and for your good work.
You too. God bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of A Reason for Hope podcast. If you haven't already done so, please like, share, follow, and subscribe. Until next time, peace.